Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Pardee School of Global Studies, the Center for the Study of Europe, and the Institute for the Study of Irish Culture at Boston University. Our speaker is James McNaughton, Associate Professor of English at the University of Alabama. Professor McNaughton's lecture is titled Samuel Beckett and the Politics of Aftermath. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Boston University Associate Professor of Humanities, Meg Tyler.
I'm delighted this evening to introduce Professor James McNaughton, who is here to give a lecture about his book from Oxford University Press. Professor James McNaughton joined at the University of Alabama English faculty in 2007. He does a great deal of archival research and examines the intersections among history, politics, and modernist aesthetics. His areas of specialty include 20th century Irish writing, British and Irish poetry, Anglo-European modernism, and critical theory. He is also a winner of the University of Alabama's Outstanding Commitment of Teaching Award, 2013. There's been much critical praise of this book. A few words from Sean Kennedy, who writes, "More than any other scholar writing today, McNaughton changes the way we read Beckett. McNaughton balances the demands of close reading with an ability to illuminate local detail in historical and theoretical context." I welcome James McNaughton.
Hello, everyone. I'm delighted and honored to be here at Boston University. This evening, I'll sketch an outline of my book, Samuel Beckett and the Politics of Aftermath, and then spend some time in the arguments of the sixth chapter on Endgame in particular, so that you can come away with a robust close reading of a work some of you may know well. My book explores Beckett's creative responses to the Irish Civil War, to the rise of fascism, and to the atrocities of World War II. I grounded in archival material, reading Beckett's letters and Beckett's diaries he kept in Nazi Germany, for instance, and demonstrating Beckett's personal attunement to propaganda and expectations for war. We see how profoundly Beckett's fiction and theatre engage with specific political strategies, rhetoric, and events. I argue that deep into literary form, syntax, and language, Beckett contends with ominous political and historical developments taking place around him. More, he satirizes moderating aesthetic and philosophical interpretations that overlook them. So there are good reasons to recognize Beckett's political aesthetic. It's surprisingly sharp and pointed. It goes overlooked. What's at stake is not simply accurate historical and cultural knowledge. In a variety of ways, this matters, of course. Both in biography and in the critical reception of his work, Beckett's apolitical reputation has stubbornly persisted. There are, of course, important exceptions. You can think of Lukács and Adorno, for instance, who debated about Beckett's work. But common is the approach of the earlier biographer Deirdre Baer, who describes Beckett as walking away from any conversation that veered into politics. This represents long-standing wisdom that was too easily applied to Beckett's creative work as well. More recent biographies, starting with Jim Nolson's, but especially Andrew Gibson's short critical biography and Emily Moran's recent book on Beckett, as well as my own biographical work, give a different picture of Beckett's political intelligence. Beckett was more politically engaged than his privacy has allowed us to see. He followed politics carefully. He read newspapers obsessively. He moved to France in anticipation of war to put himself, quote, at the disposition of that country, as he told Thomas McGreevy. He donated to the African National Congress in 1969, right after it turned violent, and Polish Solidarity in the 1980s. He took up various public causes against censorship, signing petitions and so on. What interests me more is Beckett's creative work. Beckett's political aesthetic has been overlooked partly because of the intellectual climate in which Beckett became famous, and partly, too, because critics have tended to overlook how Beckett's work examines our justifications for ignoring specific forms of political violence. The reason is also disciplinary. In the last 40 years or more, in part because cultural materialism matured in tandem with a profound suspicion of idealistic aesthetics, it can seem that literary studies makes us choose between political and contextual interpretations, and close readings sensitive to formal aesthetic effect. So choosing between political and contextual interpretations and close readings. I do think that Beckett's creative work systematically indicts an idealistic aesthetics that fails to account for cultural and political developments, how they transform the meanings of words, the function of fiction, and basic acts of interpretation. It's as if Beckett suspects the aesthetic treated idealistically as another category, much like Le Maine, that conceals le massacre, the massacres. But Beckett performs this suspicion deeply into his own project in a way that rehabilitates art's function even as it dismantles it, his famous aesthetic of failure. So some of that might seem a little abstract, but maybe some of these descriptions of the chapters now will give it a bit of colour before we get to the reading of Endgame. So chapter one develops Beckett's politics of aftermath. Aftermath, in one sense, is a convenient term to indicate Beckett's late arrival. 12 years old at the end of World War I, a teenager during the Anglo-Irish War, Beckett was only 16 in 1922 when the Irish Free State was founded and Ulysses published. Growing up in the disappointing aftermath of a so-called Irish Revolution naturally led Beckett to mistrust political rhetoric and slogan. In his 20s, he complains repeatedly about the usual politics. To quote him here, the same old Maldy words buttered around the same old Maldy ideas. His frustration with slogan, with cliché, with flinching political positions is not apoliticism. It's a restless suspicion about what takes cover under radical rhetoric, a wariness that Beckett brings also to more naive claims made on behalf of the avant-garde. We might think of an example when Nancy Cunard submits an enquete to all the writers, an inquiry to all the writers to take sides in the Spanish Civil War in about 37. Beckett responds very famously with, she says, you need to take sides. You're either for Hitler or against him. You're either for Franco or you're against him. You're either for Mussolini or against him. Authors have to take sides. It's called Authors Take Sides. And Beckett responds, up the Republic, with Spanish exclamation points. But there's also, so it seems like he's supportive of the Republic, and that's probably true. But he's also making a lesson about a political slogan as well. In Ireland, up the Republic was a sort of unifying slogan behind which you could count feminism, you could count socialism. By the time you get to 1932 and De Valera calls for an election of the Republic, he's using Up the Republic again as a slogan, and this time it's fully conservative. A few years later, after he gets in power, he puts into the Irish Constitution that a woman's place is in the home, for instance. So when Beckett's sort of giving that slogan, he's giving a lesson about what happens to politics when we think we're being radical and perhaps the language is covering conservative aspirations. By aftermath, I also refer to a technique Beckett develops early in his creative work. Beckett likes to serially modify and replay traumatic political and historical events. In the early short story collection More Pricks Than Kicks, for instance, rather than directly focus on the outrages of the war period in Ireland, the executions, the big house fires, and so on, Beckett has his main character, Balakwa, try to forget about the execution of a real-life gardener who in 1926 was charged with killing a family and burning down the house where he worked. In the last story of the collection, Balakwa's gardener rapes his maid and burns down his house. In What, a novel written a decade later, we find another gardener of a big house who gets on with his wife, we are told, like a house on fire. From major politico-historical events to copycat crimes to newspaper consumption to fictional repetition to the whole affair swallowed into the mouth of a metaphor, Beckett refuses to let it go. Rather than literature processing trauma, I think we see Beckett indict the Free State's inability to examine its foundational violence. It just keeps reappearing in his work. More, Beckett dramatizes politics itself, transforming into consumption, spectacle, and mindless repetition. So that's kind of what the first chapter does. The second chapter develops these ideas by reading Beckett's once-censored and rather astonishing story, whose title names the very process I just described, Echo's Bones. In this work, Beckett maps his analysis of recent Irish history and the crisis of political commitment in the 1930s, onto older sources in European political traditions, the French and Russian revolutions. The story, in fact, takes a structure that Beckett will rework later in Waiting for Godot. In the story, Balakwa, the indolent bourgeois poltroon, is now dead and in the afterlife, and he's literally forced to get off the fence and decide whether to help an aristocratic lord propagate his line or help an Irish peasant mujik, the word for a pre-revolutionary Russian peasant, rob Balakwa's own grave. In this story, Beckett saves a special venom for W.B. Yeats's ascendancy sympathies and the conservative political philosophy of Edmund Burke. The links to Godot are worth noting. In World War II, during the occupation of France, attentisme is the name for fence straddling, the attitude of those who refuse to resist. Attentisme, as one historian puts it, a national policy of rolling with the punches or waiting for outside salvation. Didi and Gogo confronting Lucky and Pozzo, Mujik and Master, help neither while they are en attendant their outside salvation, Godot. This post-war satire of the bourgeoisie begins in Echo's Bones. Doing nothing, not taking sides, is a political stance, one that Beckett brings under lifelong scrutiny. The third chapter draws from the archive of Beckett's letters, vocabulary, notebooks, and diaries he kept when travelling in Nazi Germany from October 1936 to 1937. I elaborate Beckett's encounters with propaganda in Nazi Germany and demonstrate how his novel Watt, written during the war, formally performs interpretative challenges presented by such propaganda. The fourth works in two directions. First, I take a good look at Beckett's literalizing techniques, how Beckett makes physical and bodily various rhetorics. He takes at its word concepts from law, economics, and political rhetoric. The technique is suitable for comic satire. So when early Beckett is writing about Irish censorship, the law requires a single text to be passed among the censors so that they can each read it before deciding whether to censor it. But if you're reading a book and you're passing it to someone else, it means you're probably pretty close to them. So Beckett puts them all in bed together, reading these books, passing them to each other, you know, and it becomes very salacious. So we get this kind of taking the law at its letter in that example as a kind of comic satire of censorship. By the late 1930s, however, it's also suitable for reflecting and engaging fears about political power, something that Beckett was very attuned to when he was travelling in Germany. Whether Hitler, for instance, means what he says, that authoritarian power aims to have the leader's words enacted, with or without the intermediary of the law. Such authority is, in a sense, artistic, the make-it-so of imaginative writing, the playwright's prerogative, an analogy Beckett exploits in later theatre, the idea that a playwright writes lines and then someone repeats them. What could be more than a political fantasy than just that? Second, this chapter examines how Beckett has his post-war narrators perform the reverse. They aim to preserve words and categories from denotations acquired by recent historical violence. In Malone Dies, the narrator tries to neutralize or make good violent history, but it resurfaces like a poorly buried mule. His central aesthetic categories, for instance, are catastrophe, elimination, annihilation, as if aesthetics can reclaim those terms from recent history that has vested them with everyday atrocity. As if artistic autonomy, artworks as a law unto themselves, as a state of exception, as if artistic autonomy doesn't also have a corollary in political history. Don't worry, gentle reader, the law doesn't apply here, and killing a character off is an aesthetic decision. Don't worry, gentle citizen, it doesn't apply here either. Beckett will work those variations in his post-war work. In The Unnameable, the novel my fifth chapter addresses, Beckett shows the incommensurability of inherited narrative and linguistic forms with recent genocide. The book performs this inadequacy in various ways. It confronts novel tropes with distorted images cribbed from memoirs of Mauthausen concentration camp, where French political prisoners were held, including Beckett's dear friend Alfred Perron. It updates the surrealist treatment of Parisian abattoirs with a newer history. Rather than see abattoirs, as Georges Bataille did, as a site of bourgeois hypocrisy, of violence we are connected to but repress. Beckett asks, with mirthless comedy, and at times it's funny as well, if abattoirs also might be the modern sign of industrialized slaughter of humans. The abattoir being the place, the word we would use to process humans. So there's a kind of wobble in Beckett's work. You're reading it one way and suddenly he confronts you with another possible interpretation that history has made possible. Finally, the narrator of this book famously attempts to deconstruct language, so fearful of is he of what it means to be alive, so desirous is he of eradicating the guilt for what has happened. Doing so, he nevertheless ends up describing figures from history he fears, bodies in heaps, missing voices of those killed without trace, and so on. Maybe language is unable to represent the real, but Beckett refuses to let this epistemological truth allow us to escape the horror of recent history. So that was a fairly quick sketch, which brings us to chapter 6, called Prophetic Relish, Famine Politics in Beckett's Endgame. Are most of you familiar with Endgame? Most of you probably know that play, or you remember it. It's the one with Ham and his servant Clove stuck in a room, resources dwindling, and outside the window, everything corpsed. You might remember the play as well because Ham's two parents are in trash cans upstage, Nag and Nell. What I argue about this play is that deep in its dramatic form, Beckett is reckoning with the famine politics of the 1930s and 40s. By famine politics, I don't just mean that famine had become a mode of ethnic cleansing that uses the alibi of natural catastrophe, but more precisely that famine was deployed in rhetorical strategies designed to accrue political power and to exact submission through threats of starvation and promises of deliverance, modes that Beckett's play treats with some detail. In the chapter before this one, I take up Adorno's notorious contention, what is, Beckett says, is like a concentration camp. Adorno's claim, I argue, is better explored in The Unnameable, as I said, where Beckett reworks details from camps. In Endgame, the atrocity invoked is not the camp, but famine. Famine was the rhetorical warning of ecological devastation that spurred along World War II, and famine was the actual outcome of prophecies of plenitude. This horrific politics of food is deeply embedded in Beckett's play. When Beckett visited Nazi Germany, remember from October 1936 to April 1937, so he's there for a good long stretch, he monitored Nazi propaganda carefully. The consequences stretch far into Beckett's mature work. Hitler cultivated catastrophic and salvationist prophecies of various kinds, and he held famine at the center. We've long known that dictators secure authority by consistently bringing about the ideological fictions they espouse. For instance, in 1930, to prepare for the physical liquidation of intra-party right and left deviationists, Stalin described them as representatives of dying classes, as Hannah Arendt has reminded us. Similarly, Hitler announces in the German Reichstag in January 1939 that if, quote, international jury of finance succeeds in plunging mankind into war, the result will be the annihilation of the Jewish race, end quote. Prophecy of a historical process not only becomes retrospective alibi, nothing happened but what had already been predicted, it also elicits scapegoating murder when the prediction fails. Famine is central to such mechanisms. When the Soviet economy was modernizing, for instance, Stalin predicted overambitious grain projections for Ukraine. When the actual grain came up short, rather than admit error, Stalin inflexibly asserted that kulaks must be stealing or hiding grain. He ordered it found, confiscating seed grain and stoking vicious classism to justify the peasantry's triumphal annihilation. This ethnic cleansing from 1932 to 33 is called the Holodomor, from the Ukrainian holod, hunger, and more to exterminate. Beckett almost certainly saw photographs of the Soviet famine in the Illustrator Beobachter, a Nazi journal Beckett came to know well in Germany. The IB published photographs of the Holodomor's starved children, heaped as corpses in a field or on bunk beds, famine-starved, heads too far back, blank eyes. Das Soviet Paradies, the Soviet paradise. The Nazis broadcast their own food plans in opposition to such wanton atrocity. but privately they also plan to commit it. Anyone who's read Mein Kampf knows, as Beckett had read it and knew, that Hitler was obsessed early on with attaining ecological self-sufficiency. Rather than importing food, he concluded that Germany's population needed to secure its ample share of soil, Lebensraum, living room, through racial war. He openly longed for Ukraine to serve as Germany's granary, as well as a source for oil. Hitler cultivates the specter of starvation in speeches throughout the 1930s, mocking the famine that Soviets produced when their land had such potential bounty. Starvation is the warning he uses to advance his ideology and the logic of war, and more practically at first, to sway German votes from communists, because famine in Ukraine proved to him how utterly inept communist leadership could be. Timothy Snyder summarizes it this way. In spring 1933, when Hitler spoke at the Berlin Sports Palace of millions of people being starved, he was appealing to the middle classes and their fears. When he continued by saying that Soviet Ukraine could be a granary for the entire world, he was speaking to his Nazi followers. He veiled one sense of Lebensraum, the bloody conquest of habitat, behind the other, the promise of physical comfort. In Hitler's war plans, he intended for Ukrainian grain to be diverted to Germany, with the intention that tens of millions of Slavs and Jews from the region would starve, a policy called hunger politic, starvation policy. He wasn't quite able to pull it off because they lost at Stalingrad, but did manage to starve 1 million people at Leningrad, 2.6 Soviet, million Soviet POWs. Snyder points out in another book called The Bloodlands that of half the people that died in this area, he's calling the Bloodlands really sort of Eastern Europe and into Soviet Ukraine, about 14 million, about half were died because they were denied food. Beckett was deeply familiar with this politics of prophecy and famine. In Germany, he becomes repulsed by how Nazis so craftily get everyone fixated on food security. Beckett arrived in Germany as the Nazi Winterhilfswerk, Winter Relief, began their annual winter charity for hungry Germans. Every family in Germany is asked to make Sunday Eintopf, one-pot casseroles made with leftovers for the week. The money saved was then to be donated to the charity for hungry Germans and later for the war effort. Ads in newspapers show Hitler and Goebbels at Eintopf, Boy Scouts at Eintopf. Feedings took place on the streets. So pervasive are these one pots that they can become shorthand for propaganda itself. This last example is from the IB. It's an ad for another Nazi journal, Die Brennessel, the stinging nettle, in which a mischievous nettle cartoon is mixing hammers and stars, hammers and sickles and stars into an Eintopf. So already the pot itself has become sort of a figure for propaganda. The pot says not meddled with. We're not meddling with Jews and communists. And then the copy says on the contrary. That's precisely what they're meddling with, since it's satire. With Eintopf, it's as if sitting down to dinner performs national solidarity, personal sacrifice. It also makes everyone inadvertently fixated on food security, which became the central logic for colonial war in the East. Beckett's diaries lament having to eat Eintopf, crawl onto restaurant where ate, not realizing it was Eintopf Sonntag, first of season. How shall I eat Eintopf tomorrow, today? Lousy Eintopf and theater keller. Go into the Aschinger, the Berlin Lyon, unspeakable Eintopf. Whee. Soon I shall be ready. Soon I shall really begin to puke or go home. This idea of puking becomes Beckett's dominant response to Nazi propaganda. So we have eating on one hand and then the desire to puke on the other. Start the vomiting moving upwards, Beckett says, in response to other Nazi propaganda. He makes a connection between Ireland and Irish stew and this German dish. It calls it Irish stew, the new German national dish in his vocabulary notebooks. If you know the novel Watt, you'll know that Beckett exploits this connection. The main character, who works in an Irish big house, both makes a pot of food, what the manuscripts call Ein Topf, the leftovers from which Watt must administer to a local famished dog. To find a local famished dog requires keeping a colony of famished dogs because they die so quickly. These dogs are kept by local impoverished families so that famished populations extend for miles in every direction. This satire, which extends for 30 pages, shows how propaganda based on supposed charity is in fact an argument for colonialism and man-made famine. In The Unnameable, this logic is brought to its conclusion, as a limbless character is placed in a pot before abattoirs and outside a restaurant, simply glad not to be poleaxed and presumably eaten himself. A scene that is only funny until we remember that Beckett himself considered cannibalism as the final degradation of the camps. So much for Ein Topf. Endgame draws from much of this history. Prophecy appears in the form of modern political rhetoric. Visions of famine and catastrophe are employed to subjugate. The play performs the consequences of mass death as a convenience. More, Endgame occurs entirely in a Lebensraum, a living room, whose affiliated granaries would ward off the ghost of famine outside and allow Ham a natural death. We are in the aftermath of that expired prospect. Everything in this play has dwindled or run out. Painkillers, pap, bonbons, rugs, bicycles, coffins. Food, however, is different. It is in part because control over disappearing food is a central method by which characters keep each other's dependent. It is as well because philosophical questions run up against the deadly historical irony that human lives have been valued at less than a heap of grain. The opening of the play has been influentially interpreted by Leo Bersani and Ulysse Dutoit as a quandary about time as death. But this existential interpretation is, I think, ironized by questions about food power and grain hoarding that dominate the entire play. Instead, time as death appears not as the universal natural condition Bersani and Dutoit imagine, but man-made and targeted, just as famine itself was in the decades before this play's writing. Interpersonal relationships are mediated with food, revealing personal tyrannies and abuse. Food supplants natural bonds of affection with threat of withholding or promise of provision. True, Nag saves Nell a piece of his dog biscuit ration, a pathetic tenderness. And Ham's central means of securing an audience from his father is to promise him a bonbon, then a sugar plum, when there are none. Empty promises, it turns out. Food control, however, casts a darker shadow that extends outwards beyond the stage, historically and politically. The conflict in the play derives from whether Clav can and will leave Ham. The ethical crisis is framed such that if Clav leaves, he will inadvertently kill the handicapped Ham and his parents, since he alone is mobile enough to tend them. In turn, Ham, with the code to the locker, keeps Clav codependent by threatening to starve him. "I'll give you nothing more to eat," he says. Or he tries to stun him with the nihilistic prophecy of Clav's own death by starvation. First Clav will go blind, then tired from hunger, sit down. "But unable to get up, you won't get anything to eat," he says. The hunger will become so severe that the walls will fade away. Infinite emptiness will be all around you. All the resurrected dead of all the ages wouldn't fill it. And there you'll be like a little bit of grit in the middle of the steppe. Ham relates this with prophetic relish. The doomster's command, ironically directed with a pun on a condiment. The language is made bitingly nastier in the English with clusters of short I sounds and the echo of empty in the final word step. Infinite will fill it, little bit of grit in the middle of the step. An equivalent pun in the French occurs when Ham promises his father un bonbon if he listens to his story. Ham's story, called his chronicle, describes how Ham interrogates a starving man whom he purportedly takes into his service. Under interrogation, the hungry man reveals to Story Ham that nobody is left alive except for his son. Non, non, personne sauf lui et l'enfant. Nobody, only him and the child, says Ham. Ham says, bon, bon. Again, je manquis de la situation à Cove, de l'autre côté du détroit, plus un chat, bon bon. So I asked about the situation in Kov, the other side. Nobody there. Good, good. Beckett translates this as good. The bon bon promised his father. Turns out to be the news, not a soul remains living. Hence fewer demands on Ham's food stocks. What Beckett does well is show how the eradication of other people is one way to aesthetically manage the story. The bonbon of mass starvation is aesthetic aid for author Ham. Killing off everyone allows him to focus the scene on the serious dilemma. It is a psychological pleasure. Author Ham can burnish his magnanimity by having Story Ham save the last starving man and child, on Christmas Eve no less. And it's an instructive pleasure. With everyone dead, Story Ham can teach the nihilistic lessons that to be saved, one must become a servant, and that the barren earth makes a child's life not worth saving. He doesn't realise. All he knows is hunger and cold and death to crown it all. But you ought to know what the earth is like nowadays. Oh, I put him before his responsibilities. It's hard to imagine a leaner presentation of recent history than the promise of food, bonbons, transformed to mere rhetoric, bonbon, words whose meaning expresses satisfaction that an entire region is emptied by starvation. It's hard to imagine a leaner example of history demolishing the metaphysics of the good. Prophetic relish is authority satisfyingly confirmed in predicted death, just as the bonbon for that sweet conclusion ironically stands in for actual food promised. The switch from the promises of sweet surplus to the scanty compensation in mass death elides what political history can take as its subject, how and why grain production failed to meet expectations and why famine ensued. Beckett prefers to investigate the rhetorical contortions. True, Beckett avoids naming the region in standard national political nomenclature, perhaps because he identifies such classification as part of the problem. But Ukraine is nevertheless brought to mind. Kov, employed in both French and English versions, is the familiar ending name for Ukrainian towns. Kharkov, of course, province and city, and even shorthand for the terror famine of 32 and 33, the Kharkov famine. But there's also Zinkov, Vasilkov, Chortilkov, Okakov, Zashkov, and so on and so on. The suffix of, occasionally given as iv, commonly denotes possession. Klov's name, whatever else it might mean, ham and clove, nail and hammer, is similarly ended, as if he himself is a living subject in the genitive, a man owned. If the initial C is hard, then the name echoes Kov. If soft, it echoes Slav. When Ham brags that he's stored food in my granaries and predicts that Klov will starve on the steppe, Ham alludes to the Ukrainian steppe known for its wondrous bounty. But Ham inverts steppe into a shattering ecology of barren hunger. In this, he follows not simply a dizzying Soviet history of the region's granaried plenitude and mass starvation. He also picks up Nazi political rhetoric as the war turned. Before the Russian offensive, Ukraine was Goring's final solution for living space and the raw material and nutritional basis of our people. After the failure at Stalingrad, Goebbels employs the threat of hordes from the steppe as the terrifying image of decimation the Soviets would purportedly unleash in Europe. Viktor Klemperer, the philologist whose diaries famously track the development of what he names the lingua terti imperii, the language of the Third Reich, identifies when steppes turns from a natural meaning, a steppe, to the political meaning in Nazi language, the steppe. Goebbels invents the image of the onslaught of the steppes, Klemperer says, and by appropriating the noun from the technical vocabulary of geography, warns everyone of the danger that Europe will be turned into steppes, Verstepung. And from this point on, die Steppe, the steppe, and Europa become part of the unique lexicon of the LTI, usually in combination. Ham's prophecy of Klov's starving on the steppe borrows this rhetoric of the Nazi regime after the loss of Stalingrad, the redoubled efforts to enshrine total war and to preclude any idea of escape. Ham uses the phrase in a similar way to sustain Klov's loyalty through threat and fear. In English, Endgame keeps the steps in mind throughout. Klov uses not ladder, as the stage directions read, but that steps. What did I do with that steps? He looks around for ladder. You didn't see that steps. He sees it. Sometimes I wonder if I'm right, in my right mind. Then it passes over and I'm as lucid as before. The dizzy spell, like Clove's visions, might be accounted for by hunger. He could also be disoriented by his use of the Hiberno-English, that steps, which suddenly recalls Ham's acid threat. In the manuscript, when Beckett first translated Fin de Partie into English, Clove uses ladder, so changing it into steps was something he added afterwards. When Beckett writes to Con Leventhal that he cannot see in what the play is particularly Irish, and then admits that there are some Irishisms in the translation liable to mislead, we might better recognise another of Beckett's typically backhanded insights about his work. To be misled by Irishisms is a long-standing aesthetic effect that Beckett's writing employs. To contrast, for example, the fantasy of Irish exceptionalism as neutral in World War II against what's happening in Europe. The point of the Irishism here is that Clove is momentarily misled. Clove's ordinary, sometimes Irish-English language for a domestic object collides with politicised historical concepts that augur mass death. When Clove turns the telescope on the audience, his slow delivery of the line employs a similar confusion. I see a multitude in transports of joy. The long pauses, and their Beckett's ellipses, hold multitudes in transports, a word uninnocent of the history of mass murder, before switching to the denotation of emotional rapture. The joke eerily compounds the physical transporting of multitudes with emotional rapture, the corollary to that mirthless quip in French, bon bon, Ham's aesthetic and logical satisfaction at regional starvation, punned on promised food. Endgame also brings our attention to recent rhetorical modes of political power when the play updates traditional uses of prediction and prophecy. Classical prophecy, where a seer tragically goes unheeded and is later mocked or admired, gives way to contemporary political prophecy, where fear of predicted catastrophe accelerates the advent of the destruction prophesied. Ham knows his prophets of doom. He updates T.S. Eliot, when there are no more coffins, he sneers post-Hiroshima, then let it end with a bang. Ham casts Clove staring at his kitchen wall as a belated Daniel, the Jewish prophet in Babylon who prophesies King Belshazzar's demise. From degree zero, culture's warnings of decline are all too late. The wall, and what do you see on your wall? Mene, mene, naked bodies? Ham's disdain is not for prophecy as such, but rather for what he intuits is Clove's agency. That Clove might rebelliously prophesy Ham's demise, and Clove escape from the present servitude and nihilism. After all, Ham admiringly reminisces about his Cassandra-like friend, the asylum painter and engraver, who thought the end of the world had come. Ham would point out to the beautiful window, the rising corn and the sails of the herring fleet, yet all the artist had seen was ashes. He alone had been spared, forgotten. It appears the case was not so unusual. From one perspective, this premonition is vigorously reinforced. The artist's visionary doom has come to pass before us on stage. And Ham seems to enjoy this alibi in inevitability, the exculpatory power of correct prediction. Yet Ham's claim that epistemological prescience, artistic intuition, or perceptive madness somehow spares the agent the calamity is twice undermined. First, by a double standard. Ham employs catastrophic prognostication to entrap Clove, which will bring about the starvation his authority depends upon preventing. Second, the painter and engraver's insight is historical and common. A version of it appears in Hitler's familiar critique of Stalin's own policy, that Stalin ineptly, or as we know, purposefully and callously, transforms surplus into strategic cleansing of the Ukrainian peasantry, a tactic Hitler actively adapted himself. Artistic insight does not lead to prevention, no more than predictive knowledge spares one. Warnings about ashes are as much the mechanism of ideological entrapment that leads to war and extermination. Whether ashes reside in plenty depends less on insight, that is, than on one's historical subject position. After all, when Clove looks out the window, he finds nature corpsed, exhausted, and extinguished, a vision little different than the institutionalized artist's. Clough's interpretation might derive from Ham's indoctrination, or because, in fact, this is what he sees, or maybe both, a composite of prophecy and outcome. Prediction and prophecy are the basic articulation of the power struggle between Clough and Ham. Even minor admissions of future action are the grounds of dramatic conflict. Most keenly, whether Clough can exercise the agency to do what he says he will. Ham prophesies starvation to psychologically entrap Clough and to aggrandize himself as a stylized savior, narrated in terms of Christian parable. Yet seems to be saved requires that Clough accept widespread starvation and the duty to exterminate, from the flea he kills to the rat in the kitchen to the boy he sees outside. There's a kind of evolution of extermination. And since it underwrites his inability to act for himself or to understand the world differently than Ham's provision, the gospel appears closer to what Beckett in Germany labelled the Nazi gospel, even as Ham draws scenarios directly from the gospel of Luke. Agency is measured by whether or not one can bring about what one says, the ability or inability to enact one's future tense. Dramatically, this boils down to whether Clough can fulfil his main prediction, echoed every 10 pages, I'll leave you. At the opening of the play, Clough is introduced in the paralysed space between prediction and inability. I'll go now to my kitchen, 10 feet by 10 feet by 10 feet, and wait for him to whistle. Clough is unable to fulfil his own predictive language. He remains a moment motionless, then goes out. He comes back immediately. Maybe you hear Yeats's The Lake Isle of Innisfree in Clough's remarks here. I will go now. That line's future tense, will go, and present adverb now, ironically undermine the assertion of going with hesitancy. Doubtless, Yeats's own quarrel with what longed-for vision of Irish national self-sufficiency might actually exact from the poet and his poetry. So for Yeats, it's a kind of a hesitancy in that poem, right? And it's his own reluctance to go where he says he wants to go. Yet Beckett's irony plumbs Yeats's source in the parable of the prodigal son. I will arise and go to my father. A need pressed upon the son because of, quote, a mighty famine on that land, end quote. And the recognition that even his father's servants have bread enough while he, quote, perishes with hunger. The son's agency in the parable, his realization of humility and submission, occurs in the text, first by predicting and articulating the steps he will take, and then by performing those actions almost verbatim. I will arise and go to my father and will say unto him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before thee, and am no more worthy to be called thy son. Make me as one of thy hired servants. And he arose and came to his father. But when he was yet a great way off, his father saw him and had compassion and ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. And the son said unto him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in thy sight, and am no more worthy to be called thy son. Endgame reads the gaps in the parable, even as Ham sentimentally employs the model to vindicate his behaviour. In his chronicle, Ham clumsily tries to style himself as the beneficent lord who saves a starving man and child. And he suggests elsewhere that Clough might be his son. In both Luke's parable and Ham's chronicle, the cause of famine is unclear. But Ham invokes prodigality as justification for letting the starving die. When it wasn't bread they wanted, it was crumpets. Out of my sight and back to your petting parties. Ham takes the man as servant, a consequence Luke quietly removes from the prodigal son's script, but does not rule out. The parable's spiritual salvation, my son was dead and is alive again, is literalized as Ham's disavowal of responsibility for the starving. Those beyond the Lord's domain are simply dead. In the parable, those within are fetted with the fatted calf, and in the chronicle, they receive the security of granaries. Ham negatively applies the formal lessons of the parable. Luke signals commitment by enacting one's own professed words, transforming I will arise into and he arose. By this standard, Ham persistently cultivates Clough's inability to commit to anything else, to do what he says, more often than not, with the same lines in the English, I'll go. So here are some examples. I'll go and get the sheet. He goes to the door. Ham, no. Again, I'll go and get the catheter. Time enough. I'll measure it. More or less, more or less. I'll go and get the tape. Roughly. I'll start straight away on the raft. Wait. Ham's persistent thwartings prevent Clav from following through. Failing this, Ham domesticates Clav's destination in your kitchen. Salvation from famine is manumission, an escape from entrapment, even to the foodless kitchen, unlikely. This is not a theatrical reflection of a meaningless world abandoned by God. Instead, Beckett draws from a political world of all too many profane saviours, in which salvation from prophesied catastrophic famine enjoins doctrinaire submission and accepting those unsaved as marked for dead, conveniently justified by their own moral debasement and inferiority. From Ham's profane theology, Beckett peels back the overlap of political power and techniques of religious authority. Profanity reveals political ideologies that draw from catastrophic prophecies and parables of salvation that mark others for dead and eventually self-consume. At this point in the book, I make a few other moves. I show that Ham's narrative of saving a child is actually part of an English literary tradition that Beckett brings under withering attention. Rudyard Kipling, for instance, has a story, William the Conqueror, about a man and a woman who save a group of starving children from an Indian famine. They stamp out famine and get married in the end. The story has no basis in historical reality. Children receive no special attention in the famine relief that he's talking about in 1896 to 97, in which 11 million died. Ham's stories borrow all the elements. His chronicle borrows all the elements. The patrician tone, the saving the child, the racism, even the ending festivities. But Beckett has him confuse the order. Ham is preparing for a party, even as the famine rages. Beckett's play seems to raise questions about whether European colonialism and European literature that covers up atrocity naturalized and helped to criminalize modern murder by starvation. There are differences in man-made genocidal famines and 19th century imperial famines that occurred naturally and whose victims received no adequate response. But maybe intent itself is under examination here too. As Beckett has Clav put it, if I don't kill that rat, he'll die. The chapter also points out that this question, whether literature is complicit in facilitating violence, is one that James Joyce's Stephen Dedalus asks of Shakespeare. In Ulysses, Dedalus claims that you can draw a line from Shakespeare's tragedies to the concentration camps in the Boer War. The blood-boltered shambles of Act 5, he's talking about Hamlet, are a forecast of the camps sung by Swinburne. Stephen thinks the play's excuses excessive retributive violence. He also argues that Shakespeare himself was a corn jobber during the famines, profited, that is, from hoarding grain to profit from it. I speculate whether Beckett performs Ham not as Prospero, as many critics have suggested, but as Dedalus as Shakespeare, the better to ask whether Western art forms are somehow complicit or inadequate to the violence they should investigate. Certainly, Beckett updates Hamlet's play within the play, designed to investigate Claudius's guilt by watching himself on stage. Instead, here, Ham reflects on his own story, even as he tells it, an astonishing theatrical innovation, one that examines guilt in the plausibility of literary deniability. Finally, I ask, why does Beckett focus on famine and not, say, concentration or death camps, as with The Unnameable? One answer is that what counted as genocide post-war was radically limited. For instance, Norman Maymark explains in Stalin's Genocides that Stalin lobbied the UN in 1948 to limit the definition of genocide to include the destruction of ethnical, racial, or religious groups, but not social or economic or political groups, which would have encompassed aristocrats, kulaks, and Trotskyites. In short, famine victims were not counted as legitimate victims of genocide. Maybe Beckett is asking, with typical immoderation, why not? Thanks.
That was a wonderful talk, James. And
oh, thanks, Meg.
A mirror of our dark times in many ways. When you were talking about what Close says, I'll leave you.
Yeah.
It reminded me of something Stephen Ray, the actor Stephen Ray, mentioned when he performed in Endgame. Wow. And he asked Beckett, with what intention do I say this? You know, when I say I'll leave you, yeah, does it mean I'm going to leave you forever and ever? Or am I just going to the kitchen to get something to eat?
Yeah.
And Beckett said, it's always ambiguous.
Yeah.
And I think that's it's one thing that draws me to him again and again. He's never force-feeding us,
yeah,
just to borrow your food metaphor.
Yeah.
But I delight in not being told how I should feel or respond. That's not really a question.
Do I violate your sense of freedom by talking about the play in this way?
Not in any way, James.
Well, no, I mean it seriously. Yeah. Like, I mean, one of the things that might make someone uncomfortable is I mean, the reading here is almost allegorical in a way, right? I mean, we're sort of, it's not to the extent that I feel like Beckett's borrowing rhetoric and performing it in a domestic situation, just like the one you've described. Is he going to the kitchen or is he leaving him? He does talk about getting a raft and sailing away. So there is some sense that he does want to leave him. But there's something about readings like this that go too far. And then Beckett has them pull back in precisely the way you've said. He kind of moderates the reading, not because it's not there, but because he just pulls it back a little bit. I don't know. He doesn't let Clav leave. And you might think about that too, like right. Why he's not allowed leave. He waits until everything is completely gone before he's going to think that maybe, well, he's had too much. I mean, he's dressed at the end to leave, but he doesn't, right? I don't think... I mean, his leaving would also kill Ham, and if Ham is the landlord or whatever, I mean, there seems to be a kind of ethical, moral reason to hold him on stage there, to not let him leave. Because you can't just justify Clav as a victim if he's also going to be killing them if he leaves.
Well, thank you so much, James. What a pleasure for all of us. We're really grateful. Thank you.
Thanks everyone for showing up.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by James McNaughton, Associate Professor of English at the University of Alabama. Professor McNaughton's lecture was titled Samuel Beckett and the Politics of Aftermath and was presented by the Boston University Pardee School of Global Studies, the Center for the Study of Europe, and the Institute for the Study of Irish Culture at Boston University. Tonight's moderator was Boston University Associate Professor of Humanities, Meg Tyler. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Matt Lissette. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Jack Lepiars. Thanks for joining us.